supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. My guest, Deanna Fay, went into labor when she was just 5.5 months pregnant. She's written about the experience in a new memoir, Girl in Glass, and it's quite a story on many levels. The subtitle is How My Distressed Baby Defied the Odds, Shamed a CEO, and Taught Me the Essence of Love, Heartbreak, and Miracles. We're going to touch on all of those issues during this hour. But first, let me welcome Deanna Fay. Welcome to the show, and thanks so much for schlepping down here from New York.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
So a major piece of your story is that in 2012, Tim Armstrong, then and now CEO of AOL, made the following statement. He said, quote, "We had two AOLers that had distressed babies that were born that we paid $1 million each to make sure those babies were okay. And those are the things that add up to our benefits cost. So when we had to make the final decision about what benefits to cut because of the increased health care costs, we made a decision, and I made the decision, to basically change the 401k plan." We'll get into that statement and what it really means, what impact it had, not just to my guest, but to AOL, in just a few minutes. But first, I want to talk about your daughter, Mila or Myla?
Mila.
Mila. She was one of those so-called distressed babies. What is it about that word that troubles you?
Distressed babies is not a term that I had ever heard before, and certainly not in terms of describing a child who overcame what my daughter did. It brought to mind business terms like distressed merchandise, basically damaged goods. And I think that that judgment was certainly implicit in the way that Armstrong portrayed these children as outsized burdens on the corporate balance sheets.
It's interesting. When I read that in your book, that word, it didn't bother me at all because I'm a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And distress has a whole different meaning.
Right. And
people who were distressed, they come for treatment. But I want to get to know a little bit about Mila. Tell us about those early days and weeks.
Well, the first days and weeks of her life were some of the darkest and most terrifying moments of my life. When she was born, I didn't know if she was going to survive 1 week, 1 month, let alone the next day. And I also didn't know if she should, because I didn't know what kind of life she might go on to lead. I was told that she had quite high odds of surviving with severe disabilities. And I also, in terms of what her existence was at that moment, it seemed to me that she looked like she was suffering. And I wasn't sure if the heroic interventions to save her life were truly what I wanted for her as her mother. Of course, I wanted nothing more than to protect her from all the perils in her path. And I was helpless. I couldn't hold her. I couldn't nurse her. I couldn't hear her cries. All I could do was reach into the incubator and hold her hand.
And protecting her from those perils might have meant less medical intervention.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the central dilemma in treating premature infants and in treating many sick newborns in general, which is that there are cases where treatment is actually inhumane, if it might be futile, if the life saved might entail tremendous pain and suffering. And I think we all hear the word preemie, and we tend to think of, you know, these perfect babies in miniature who you can hold in the palm of your hand, and you hear the term miracle child, and you hear, oh, you know, they're going to be just fine. And I think that obscures the reality that for babies like my daughter, the perils are great, and the odds are extremely steep, and there's tremendous uncertainty in terms of what her life would turn out to be.
Did you feel like you were in shock during those early days and weeks, in hindsight now?
I was absolutely in shock. And I think, you know, when I was rushing to the hospital, I couldn't believe that I was actually in labor. You know, this was my second child. My first child had been born on his due date, you know, and full term, perfectly healthy, 7 pounds, 10 ounces. That was my idea of how life begins. That was my idea of a birth. And I think that when it hit me that I was probably going to lose this child, I shifted into self-preservation. I actually told myself, I'm having a miscarriage. And I told myself, I don't know this child yet, and this isn't the worst thing in the world. I think, you know, we all have an instinct to protect ourselves from the most terrible loss. And I think for many of us, the worst loss we can imagine is the loss of a child.
You didn't give her a name.
I didn't give her a name for the first 2 days of her life. My husband and I hadn't even had a chance to talk about really what name we wanted for our daughter when this happened, because I was just 25 weeks along.
Was it just that?
It was partly that, and it was also the fear of getting attached and owning her as my daughter, because I think, you know, for as long as I could tell myself, and it wasn't for long, of course, that I could tell myself this, that she's not really a baby, then I could also delude myself into thinking that maybe I can protect my own heart from breaking. And it really wasn't until I reached into her incubator for the first time and she held onto my hand that it hit me, you know, this is my daughter. And whatever her life turns out to be, however long she lives, you know, I have to hold her.
And, when did that happen?
And naming her as part of that. That happened, I think that happened on her second day of life.
What was that like when you felt her fingers?
Her fingers were so tiny that they hardly felt like fingers. They felt like something like the tendrils of a pea, you know, the fins of a minnow, just something that was so tiny, and yet they had a purpose. I mean, I reached my hand into her incubator. She couldn't breathe on her own. She couldn't feed on her own. Her skin couldn't hold itself together, but she held onto my finger, and I really feel like from that moment on, she led the way.
How so?
She taught me how to be her mother. You know, I think until then, I already had a one-year-old son at home. I was full of these ideas about, you know, how to do everything right as a parent.
Yeah, we all did.
Exactly. All the ideas about sleeping and feeding, you know, breastfeeding, how long to breastfeed, you know, the different parenting styles, being a Chinese parent, being a French parent, all of that. And I think I was steeped in this notion that, you know, you can do everything right somehow and your baby will be perfect. Of course, that's not rational, but I think, you know, that certainly played into my thinking. And tied up with that then is also these anxieties about, you know, you could do everything wrong also. But with my daughter, she taught me to live in each moment. And that doesn't mean that each moment is a celebration. You know, each moment can be a moment when you're just rooting for her to take the next breath. You know, that moment can be a moment when you're watching her oxygen levels plummet and just hoping that they will rise back up. But it's a moment to be there with your child. And if you're not there for those moments, you're missing out.
At that moment, you felt her hand around your finger. She became your child, your daughter. You were able to open your heart. And still, if memory serves me correctly, the chances of her survival were 1 in 3. Do I remember that?
The chances of her dying before we could ever bring her home was 1 in 3. And I didn't know how long she would be holding my hand, but I knew that for as long as she was holding my hand, I had to be there with her and to trust in the rightfulness of her existence, whatever it was going to be.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Deanna Faye. She's written Girl in Glass. It's a memoir about, so many things, a premature baby, about the injustice of our healthcare system, about love in the face of uncertainty, and even miracles. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Give us a call if you'd like to chat with Deanna Faye or tell your story about your experience of having a premature birth. I've got to tell you, one thing that really strikes at this is you talk about your pediatrician, Dr. Khan, and your husband asked her the chances of the baby living, and she looked in your eyes and she started to cry.
Yes. And
that speaks to the situation. It speaks to her humanity.
Absolutely. And that was a moment that I was grateful for then, and I'm grateful for every day since then, because as soon as my daughter was born, there was also this talk of congratulations, you know, and she'll be a miracle child, when I had no idea what her future was going to be. And in hindsight, I understand now that some of the talk of congratulations was an acknowledgement that however catastrophic this birth was, and catastrophic was the word that the doctors used, this is also the birth of a baby. But at the time, it almost seemed like a farce to me. You know, like, why are we pretending that something happy happened when this is the worst catastrophe that my family has ever faced? So when the doctor looked into my eyes and started to cry, that was an acknowledgement of the reality of our situation.
It was, in my mind, if I may, Deanna, it was even when that. I mean, it really spoke to her humanity and her compassion.
Yes.
For you, your husband, for this baby.
Yes.
Was that unusual in your experience? She was in a NICU, neurological intensive care unit, for 3 months, multiple hospitalizations, I assume.
She had basically one extended hospital stay. She was in the hospital for 3 months, for the first months of her life. I mean, I will say that the doctors and nurses who treated her are heroes, and they will always be heroes in our family. And I think they deserve to be widely recognized for the hugely important work that they do. I think, of course, you know, the daily nature of the work of confronting such momentous perils every day is that sometimes you can't help but have tunnel vision. And, you know, you're focused on inserting this chest tube into this baby at this moment. And a lot of the bigger picture by necessity has to fall away. But I do think that that doctor in particular, and many of the doctors that we dealt with, were able to see her as a human being and see us as parents, you know, with another child at home, and at least acknowledge that her life can't only exist in this bubble of the NICU, and that, you know, my husband and I had our own struggles and our own heartbreak and our own agony of uncertainty, even as every moment that we were in the hospital, all we could do was be there with her and fight with her.
You know, I'm thinking as I listen to you tell this story of Dr. Khan, you know, I hearken back to what we talked about a few minutes ago, right after the baby was born, and how you had to keep your heart closed, how you were afraid to open it to love. And that's very understandable. It's very human.
Yeah.
You know, it's what we do. And boy, you talked about these doctors and nurses, and they do that every day.
They do that every
day. All day, every day.
And, you know, that doctor, even after we had that conversation and she started to cry, and that was also right after she gave us the news that our daughter had suffered a brain hemorrhage, when she left the room, she said, "Have you picked a name yet? Have you given her a name?" So at the same time, you know, she was acknowledging, of course, you're heartbroken at this moment, but that's your daughter, and she needs a name like any other child.
So, how did you pick that name, and why?
There was just one name that stuck with me somehow, and I didn't know anyone by that name. I didn't really know what the name meant, but the name was Mila. And my husband and I discussed it. You know, we weren't sure. We looked it up, and then we saw that one of the meanings of this name was miracle. And immediately I just said, you know, I don't think that's the name for us, because I don't want to lay this burden on her of having to be this, you know, inspirational, feel-good story when she should just be however she is, you know, whatever her life turns out to be.
Well, that didn't turn out well, did it?
But the name just stuck with me. And then we found another definition that was dear one, and that struck a chord. So we decided that's the name. And then late on the second day, we went to her bedside. We were about to tell the nurses and doctors that this was her name. And then the nurse who was tending her at that moment had this ID tag on her chest, and the tag said Mila. And we stared at her and we couldn't make sense of this. And she just introduced herself and she said, you know, my name's Milagros. And we chatted a little bit. Milagros is short for Milagros means miracle. And I think, you know, I'm not the kind of person who ever expected this story to turn out the way that it has, but I also feel like my daughter has charted her own path and she's earned it.
Let's go to the phones. We've got somebody who wants to join the conversation. Steve, we've got Steve on the line. Hi, Steve.
Yes, how are you?
Good, thanks. Yourself?
Very well, thanks.
When I
heard what you were talking about, I just thought I would just give a call because my wife and I had a very similar experience. Our daughter was 15 and a half ounces when she was born. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. And she faced a lot of the things that you're talking about. And this past Friday, she just turned 25.
How is she?
Fantastic. She's she works full time. She really has no residual effects of being that small. It's a true miracle.
Yeah, 25 years ago. How long was she in ICU?
She was in Our Lady of Lourdes for 4 months. So we took her home in November. She was born July 10th, and we took her home in November.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Steve. I appreciate
it. You're welcome.
What's that like for you when you hear that?
Hearing these stories is the most moving and profound experience that I've had in my life. After the media firestorm about Tim Armstrong and distressed babies, and after I came forward to defend my daughter and to defend her right to the care that saved her life, I received an outpouring of messages from strangers across the country who said, in effect, let me tell you about my quote-unquote distressed baby. And many of them co-opted this term with dignity and with pride, mm-hmm. and in a way that allowed me to connect with them over traumas that had once seemed unspeakable. And the support and the solidarity that they offered to me was transformative. They really showed me the power of telling our stories, even when those stories seem to be overlaid with shame and guilt and fear, because, you know, when a baby is born who faces steep odds like these, those are the emotions that swirl around their births. But at the same time, the story of how our children arrived in the world is one of the most fundamental stories we ever tell.
Sure.
And they also brought home for me the fact that each child is all of our children. And we're at a dangerous place in society when we start labeling children with price tags and assessing them as burdens.
When we take our break, which we have to do now for just a minute, I want to come back and talk about that issue with you, about labels, mm-hmm. about price tags on babies, and your relationship now with Tim Armstrong, or your feelings about Mr. Armstrong today. But I also want to talk about, and it's very uncomfortable for me to even bring it up, the realities, the economic realities of how we balance all of those factors. And is it limitless? Are we? It's awkward. It's uncomfortable. There's no answers. I mean, my God, it's uncomfortable for me to even bring it up, let alone have a discussion about it. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about Deanna Faye. She's the author of Girl in Glass. It's a memoir about her experience of giving birth prematurely, but so much more. And not only that, not only is it an important story, it is so well written. I highly recommend it. So if you've got an experience with having a premature baby, or maybe you were a premature baby, I read that my Deanna was a premature baby, and maybe we'll get to that also. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at karen.org. That's CARON.org.
Supporting WHYY, Devereaux, one of the leaders in behavioral health care, helps to provide care for children and adolescents with mental health challenges, as well as individuals of all ages living with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Across its national network, Devereaux helps provide meaningful care to individuals and families where they need it most. Whether it be through community and educational programs, employment services, foster care assistance, or individual or group living support. Learn more at devereaux.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking with Deanna Faye, who's written Girl in Glass. It's a memoir about, well, many things, a premature baby and many other things, including trauma. I mean, by any definition, Deanna, what you and Peter, your husband, went through constitutes trauma. What was it like when you got home with Mila? Were you afraid to sleep? I mean, for the first time, you had no medical team keeping an eye on her.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, bringing her home was as if all of the most amazing, beautiful parts of having a new baby were suddenly restored to us. She came home with no medical equipment, no special instructions, you know, just she was like any other newborn baby, if tinier than most. And every moment that we watched her sleep, that we held her, that I nursed her, was a blessing. At the same time, I had a very strong, lingering fear that at any moment she could slip away from me all over again. Because the nature of her birth was so sudden and so inexplicable, you know, with no warning signs and no explanations, part of me always lived in fear that I could lose her again. I could lose her again and again, all over again. So I definitely, in hindsight, was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. I had flashbacks, you know, I would have panic attacks. But then I would look at her face and that would strengthen me.
Do you still? You put all that in past tense.
Yeah.
You said you had a lot of anxiety.
Yeah. I definitely still do. But writing this book has been hugely cathartic for me. Confronting the darkest moments that as they were happening, I was always kind of trying to extricate myself from, in a way, because some of it seemed unbearable. You know, the calls that I would get from the NICU about her lung collapsed or she stopped breathing tonight. Having to write those scenes moment by moment forced me to relive them. But at the same time, reliving them helped me to see that everything that happened is part of who she is, and part of who she is part of who I am. And as much as I would like to still protect her from all the suffering in the world, you know, I also want her just the way that she is.
Yeah, we all want to protect our children from all the suffering in the world. So, Deanna, while you're dealing with this trauma, Tim Armstrong, as I mentioned in the first segment, who was and is the CEO of AOL, said that he had to cut back on benefits because there were two distressed, quote, distressed babies that cost $1 million each. What was the impact? What happened to you when you first heard that statement? And when was it relative to when Mila got out of the hospital?
It was actually almost exactly a year after she came home from the hospital, and it was the same week that she took her first steps, which was a huge milestone in our family. And I had just been starting to feel like my fists are unclenching, I'm breathing a little bit easier, maybe everything is going to be okay, when I got this email from my husband with all these headlines about AOL CEO blames benefit cuts on distressed babies. And I think for the first couple of days, I was in shock and denial and trying to tell myself this has nothing to do with me and my family. And as the media firestorm raged on and his comments resounded over and over in headlines and cable news discussions, then it struck me that in some ways he's voicing all this shame and guilt, the sense of failure that I've imposed on myself ever since she was born. And coming forward was essential to me in confronting all of that and in saying, she has nothing to be ashamed of, and I'm proud of her for everything that she's overcome.
This says something about your wiring, because many would withdraw, would be angry, that's what we do when we're exposed, when our most vulnerable parts of ourselves are exposed. You know, either withdrawal or lash out. Those are the two typical reactions.
I did want to withdraw. I wanted to hide from the world. I felt completely exposed and completely vulnerable. But I just felt like I had to defend my daughter's basic humanity. And
how did you do that?
Well, in telling the story of how she was born and explaining why she needed the medical care that saved her life, but also to make the point that she suffered a medical catastrophe, and that's the fundamental purpose of health insurance, is to cover individuals in the event of unforeseeable disasters that no individual can forestall, but in the aggregate, we can protect ourselves by having insurance, and that's why we do. And health benefits are there to be used. And to single out any individual for their medical expenditures undermines the very purpose of health insurance.
Before we get to HIPAA and all those things,
right,
how Tim Armstrong even knew about all this, but before we get to that, we've got to talk about Peter. And Peter was working for AOL. He was an editor.
Right.
So a lot of this was filtering through him. My God, I can't even imagine what it was like for him.
Yeah, he was at work. His job was as a business and tech editor at the Huffington Post, which was owned by AOL. And he actually had to oversee coverage of this breaking news story as his coworkers were saying to him, isn't the CEO talking about your baby? And so I think at first he also was able to shield himself from the emotional impact of these comments by being in his journalist mode. But as soon as he came home to me, the devastation for him was, I think, just about as great as it was for me. And, you know, back to your question about what it would be like for, I think, most people to suffer a violation of this nature. What really struck me when I heard from, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of people who told me, I've too, have been targeted in the workplace for my medical bills. Of course, it's hard for people to speak up in these situations. And I consider myself and my family extremely blessed in that if the worst had happened, if I had come forward and then my husband had been suddenly fired and we had found ourselves, you know, without paychecks and without a health insurance policy, you know, I knew that we wouldn't end up on the street. That's not the case for a lot of working families. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely hard to speak up against your employer when they have direct power over you, and especially when a lot of families in these situations are still struggling to recover from those medical traumas.
So did Peter speak up to Tim Armstrong? Did you?
Peter did directly tell Tim Armstrong.
One-on-one,
in an email, how hurtful this was for our family and how it had resurfaced all of the trauma that we had been trying so hard to forget. Tim Armstrong at that point did apologize to him and said that some further statement would be forthcoming, but then he also quickly pivoted to being my husband's boss and asking him to talk to HR about the best ways to communicate with employees about these changes. And what my husband asked for was a public apology, because even at that point, it struck him that, you know, wronged as we may be, our family was one of the more fortunate families in America today. But what about families who can't protect themselves from being mistreated, from being targeted, from being shamed in the workplace for these medical bills that they can't help?
One last question about Tim Armstrong. Yeah. And Peter and you. I'm really touched by both of your reaction to this, because as a reader, my reaction wasn't gentle at all.
Hmm.
I was enraged at that kind of statement, and I wondered if his apology made you feel better. I also wonder if Peter is still working for AOL and how you guys both are feeling about Tim Armstrong today.
When Tim Armstrong reached out to me after my piece ran,
he
apologized graciously on a personal level, and I forgave him on a personal level, and I appreciated the fact that he genuinely seemed to feel bad about what he had done. But I think that this is about a lot more than me versus Tim Armstrong. And I think that his comments revealed a lot of bigger and quite dangerous issues that confront many working families in America today. One of them is the fact that our health information is vulnerable to CEOs monitoring them, and also to CEOs targeting individuals who stand out on the balance sheet.
In a way, HIPAA is kind of a sham.
Exactly. You know, HIPAA is not anything that I knew anything about until this happened to me. And to be honest, the emotional impact of the violation was so foremost that even when reporters and observers were talking about HIPAA and whether this qualified as a HIPAA violation, the legal aspect of it seems strangely irrelevant. What I subsequently came to see is that, well, of course the law matters, because if ordinary Americans can't protect ourselves from these violations by law, then where are we as a society? So HIPAA is the law that does provide some degree of protection for our medical data. But in the context of the workplace, essentially HIPAA regulates that our health information should be anonymized before it can be shared or disclosed. So the fact that Armstrong made my family identifiable means that in itself qualifies as a HIPAA violation. But the fact is that most violations of this nature don't occur on stage at a town hall meeting, and most people don't know about it when it occurs. So what's remarkable about what happened to my family is that we know about it and that it generated so many headlines and that we're still talking about it. It's not the fact that working Americans do get targeted very commonly in the workplace for their most sensitive personal information. And in most cases, they don't have much recourse at all.
What needs to be done to protect them?
Well, I think for starters, we need legislation. I think, you know, the reality is that healthcare costs have risen exponentially in the last few decades, just as most companies have become relentlessly focused on cutting labor costs. That's a fundamental and growing tension that has motivated many employers to closely monitor employees' personal health. Some of that can be ostensibly legal and even progressive in terms of promoting wellness programs and things like that. However, there's a very fine line, and I think, you know, we see it crossed again and again, where it's also very easy for employers to spot a high-cost individual and then look for ways to essentially kick them off, whether that's by shaming them, blaming them, demoting them, reassigning them, or even firing them. A lot of that can happen in a gray area of the law. And right now, we don't have protections in place that most people can access.
We're gonna have to take a short break. I want to talk about the cost of human life, and I want to read something when we come back that was right on the CDC's webpage. I'll read you the first paragraph about premature births. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Deanna Fay. She is the author of Girl in Glass. That girl in glass is Mila, who was a premature baby who is now 2 years old. And in a way, she is a miracle. Her name is miraculous. And it brings up so many other issues, healthcare, HIPAA, whether or not it works or if it really exists, and so many other issues. Our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Do you know someone with mild to moderate Alzheimer's? A clinical drug is being conducted to evaluate the safety and effectiveness of a study drug for the treatment of symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. Qualified participants must be 55 to 85 years old and have a support person to attend study visits. Qualified participants receive study-related medical care, memory testing, and routine lab work. Details at 215-884-1700, 215-884-1700. The Clinical Trial Center supports WHYY.
Hi, this is Robert Siegel of NPR's All Things Considered, your evening news destination. You know, events unfold throughout the day between Morning Edition and All Things Considered, so tune in for Here and Now with Jeremy Hobson and Robin Young. It's in-depth news, analysis, and extraordinary stories that you won't hear anywhere else.
Get more interesting this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family with Deanna Fay. Please pick up her book. It's just extraordinary. No, I was not paid for that endorsement. So I said, Deanna, before a break, that in my research I looked up the CDC webpage on premature births, and the opening paragraph was all about statistics and incidence and prevalence and morbidity and mortality. The last sentence, opening paragraph, was that preterm birth rates cost the U.S. healthcare system more than $26 billion. Now, there's a lot of ways to react to that fact. What's yours?
I'm certainly not here to say that healthcare spending should be unlimited or that every child must be saved at all costs. But when we talk about the value of a human life, you know, the ethical questions to ask are, you know, about pain and suffering or the kind of life that this child will go on to live. And the other thing that we have to remember when we talk about healthcare costs is that these numbers are completely manipulated by the healthcare industry. You know, when we say $1 million for a human life, we're also talking about a system where a box of tissues is $11 and a single stitch is $500. So for any CEO to use these numbers to put a price tag on a child's life, it's not only cruel, it's actually completely dishonest. And it's a completely separate question of what the hospital paid, what the insurance paid, what AOL might have actually paid, and what my daughter's life is actually worth. You know, I've since found out that the care of premature infants is actually one of the things that we can be proudest of in terms of our healthcare system. It's one of the great success stories of innovation and the interplay of technology and law and politics and science. It's kind of, you know, a shining example of our humanity at its best. And if we're going to talk about these cost-benefit analyses, the cost of treating premature infants is actually, it's actually extremely cost-effective because most premature infants do go on to leave completely rich, full, meaningful lives like any other children.
I should mention, just as a tagline to what you're saying, in 2013, Pope Francis called unfettered capitalism a new tyranny.
I mean, you know, it is striking to me that many of us can't help reacting to this number, you know, $1 million for a single life. It's staggering, you know. I mean, to me, like as to anyone else, at the same time, something like $12 million for a CEO salary, that's completely ordinary. We don't flinch at that at all.
Tim Armstrong makes just south of $7 million.
Well, his salary in 2012, the year that my daughter was born, was actually $12 million, including bonuses. And, you know, there was some blowback about, well, you know, how many distressed babies could Tim Armstrong have personally paid for? But what was most striking to me about that figure was the fact that his bonus was actually pegged to his cost cutting. Mm. And when he made these comments, AOL had just posted its best earnings in years. So there was no reason that anything had to be cut at all, let alone blaming babies for these cuts. So I think it's important to have a rational conversation about healthcare costs, especially when we live in a society where so many people are still uninsured. But I think there's also a tendency to create these false zero-sum games that actually don't have to exist at all.
I think to have that conversation, Deanna, people have to be willing to be uncomfortable.
I think you're right.
To let go of their damn dogma and open up and start off being confused, not knowing answers.
Right. And that was certainly the mentality that I had to put myself in to dig into all of these issues, because I really didn't start out with any agenda. I wasn't sure what I would find out about what my daughter's care costs, you know, whether her care was essentially a moonshot, you know, and if she defied the odds, then what about all the babies who don't? There's also this assumption that's, of course, usually unspoken, that because so much care and so much resources, both, you know, in terms of time and money, go into the care of these babies, that somehow they must turn out to be these unscathed miracle children in order to justify their existence.
Right.
And I definitely struggled with that. There was always a part of me that was afraid, well, you know, what if she never walks? You know, what if she can't feed herself? What will that say? And I'm undeniably blessed in that my daughter is as healthy and indomitable as she is. But what I've also come to see is that, you know, the future is not guaranteed for her, as it's not guaranteed for any of us. She could still receive a worrying diagnosis in a few months, in a few years. And if she did, the value of her life would not be any less.
I have been giving out the phone numbers the whole show, and I have not been letting people talk to you because I want to talk to you, and it's my show. Let's go to the phones anyway. We've got Peter on the line. Hey, Peter.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. What can we do for you?
A couple of things. Quickly on your last point, perhaps the problem is we've lost this concept of caring for others, and we may want to examine how badly we've lost it. But two things your listeners should know. First, on authorizations, read the entire authorization. I've had clients who are asked to sign ones that almost said Ed McMansell, if you don't sign today, we can't give your information to other people.
We should say you're an attorney, Peter, yes?
Yes. And secondly, there is a Children's Social Security, Children's SSI program. Anybody who has a child who has some type of catastrophic or huge medical expense illness, I'd advise apply for that immediately, If you're denied, you can decide whether to appeal or apply again, but keep knocking on the door. But that will hopefully help fill gaps, especially for the many families who have insurance, but it has bunny ears around it because there's a $7,000, $11,000, I've even seen, deductible, which for your average family is virtually unaffordable.
Peter, your opening comment was people should read the authorization completely. And my first reaction was, really, Peter? I mean, really? Are we going to read that legalese of, you know, people who wrote that are scared to death of periods? They just love commas. And, you know, I mean, we're not going to do that. You know, it's not
real. I understand, but you can. And a lot of it you can basically strike out because your insurance company says we have a right to look at medical records. Fine. But that doesn't give them a right to look at every record, you know, for an unrelated illness all the time. And part of this database explosion is because technology has no longer limited us. We used to be limited, or insurance companies were limited, by how much paper they could store. Now the lid's off as much as they want, and they are.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But what's, I think, especially chilling about workplace violations of health privacy is that employees don't have much choice in terms of what they want to sign if they're dependent on their employers for their health care. And also, you know, I mean, it's perfectly legal for our personal health information to be bought and sold and traded by data miners and banks and mortgage companies if that information has been so-called anonymized. But in the context of a workplace, it's extremely easy for employers to attach to easily identify individuals according to their medical conditions, including those of their families.
Peter, thanks so much for your call. So HIPAA needs to be modified.
HIPAA was essentially gutted when the right of consent was eliminated by the Bush administration. And since then, we essentially have no control over our medical records, and all the forms that we sign in some ways only provide the illusion that we do. So what we really need is legislation to protect our right to health privacy. And what I've learned from all of this is that health privacy is not an abstract issue. It's not theoretical at all. In fact, it's a bread and butter issue for so many Americans. And without the right to health privacy, we can't protect ourselves from the threat of having our personal health information used against us by cost-cutting employers.
And even the provisions in the so-called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, insurance companies can get in there and restrict coverage for pre-existing conditions?
I mean, one of the experts that I talked to in the book actually works for a private insurance company, and part of his job is to look for ways to eliminate high-cost individuals through loopholes. I think certainly Obamacare has provided hugely important protections, especially in terms of pre-existing conditions, but it's also increased incentives for employers to provide health insurance, and for the near future, most will continue to do so. At the same time, most show little signs of shifting away from these short-term strategies of, you know, maximizing profits for shareholders and CEOs and offsetting those costs on the backs of employees.
Unfettered capitalism. Let's talk about where we started off. I want to know how Mila's doing today. I wonder how old she is. I want to hear about her big brother, too.
Mila is now 2.5, and she's getting all of the mileage she can get out of her terrible twos. She throws tantrums with the best of them. She eats cookies faster than her big brother. She's extremely proud of all of her accomplishments. She loves to scramble to the top of a jungle gym or, you know, spot the first star at dusk and say, you know, look, Mama, I did it. Mama, I can see the moon. And when she says things like that, you know, things that I at one point never thought I might hear from her, it stills my heart.
Are you a different person?
I think I'm a completely different person. I'm a completely different parent than I was before I had her.
Talking about your humanity, Deanna.
Yeah.
Are you a different person?
Yes. I think my daughter has expanded my humanity. And she's also challenged my definition of it. becoming her parent has forced me to confront some of my worst fears that I wouldn't have even known how to voice. And I think for many of us, there's a huge and pervasive fear of death and also equally of disability. You know, in the aftermath of the controversy, I actually received plenty of messages from people that basically suggested, you know, your daughter probably shouldn't have received the care that she did. And in fact, I, you know, subsequently found that in the conversation about premature infants, there's often this talk of these babies being essentially damaged goods, because some babies do survive with permanent disabilities having been born prematurely.
Listen, as a guy who has a permanent disability, you can have a broken body and still have well-being, happiness,
absolutely,
love, generosity, and help make the world a better place.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's been one of the central lessons that I've learned. I mean, in some ways, the fear of disability is bizarre in that at any moment, any one of us could be struck by this kind of misfortune. And if it comes to our own loved ones, who of us would question their right to care that might give them the chance at a full life?
Well, it's what that attorney said. We have a significant compassion deficit in this country. And I'll, as a clinician, I'll say we've got a significant self-compassion deficit. You know, we're self-serving, but we do lack self-compassion. Mila's brother is 3 and a half.
That's right.
And Mila is 2 and a half in the terrible twos. You came down here from New York. Tell me the truth. Are you running away from home? I won't tell anybody. It'll be our secret.
You know, it is true that any few minutes of peace and quiet on a train are a few minutes of peace and quiet that I cannot get at home.
Oh, yeah. we've all been there. We've all been there. I want to thank you so much for coming down, for joining us, and sharing your terribly important story with us.
Thank you so much for having me on today.
Deanna Fay is the author of Girl in Glass, a memoir of her experience with Mila. Follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. Our email address is voices@whyy.org. My email is drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luner is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Leah Kaufman is our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voice in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week.